I'm JJ.
And I'm Dan.
And we are the men who explain miracles. Welcome back to The Men Who Explain Miracles, a podcast about impossible crime fiction.
Last week we looked at Golden Age detective writer S.S. Van Dine's 20 Rules for Detective Fiction. This week we are looking at Ronald Knox's famous Decalogue, his 10 commandments, as it were, for the idea of rules, regulations, and laws in Golden Age detective fiction. JJ, give us some context. Tell us a little bit about Knox and what this Decalogue is all about.
So Knox didn't actually write hugely in the genre. He wrote a handful of novels, he wrote a handful of short stories. I did not realise until Dolores Gordon Smith gave an extremely entertaining talk on him at Bodies from the Library, the British Library last year, that the thing he was originally best known for in terms of detection circles was that in 1911 he published a series of essays about aspects of the Sherlock Holmes canon, entitled Studies in the Literature of Sherlock Holmes.
What's become a whole thing, hasn't it? A genre. What's it called? Like Sherlockianism or Holmesism or something like that, isn't it?
Yeah. Sherlockiana or something.
As if he was existing in the real world, yeah.
So in this, Knox sort of posits this idea that actually, up to a certain point, the Sherlock Holmes stories are legitimate cases which Dr. Watson legitimately witnessed and has accurately and faithfully recalled.
Historical documents.
Right.
Yeah.
But then comes a point, I believe the final problem is the point where he suggests that actually Holmes dies at the Reichenbach Falls.
Mm.
And then Watson, who has various financial issues, then just starts inventing cases.
Cases from there.
Okay. And he goes through and very rigorously, with his tongue at times wedged very firmly in his cheek,
yeah,
picks up the differences stylistically in terms of character between the early Holmes stories, which are the genuine article, and the later ones. And he says there are things like, possibly my favourite line in the whole thing is, the true Holmes never splits an infinitive. The Holmes of the return stories splits at least three. And there are these very arch reflections, I suppose is probably the best word for it, on the ways in which the Sherlock Holmes stories have gradually changed. Doyle was famously very bad at consistency. Either that, or there are hilarious things inside of his universe never explored, like the fact that Professor Moriarty's parents were astoundingly unimaginative when it came to naming their children, because there's Professor James Moriarty and his brother James Moriarty. And so, like, Doyle was never a big one for consistency. Watson's bullet wound moves around his body. So I think it's in his shoulder, it's in his leg, it's in various different places according to the stories that you read. I was interested to see what Doyle made of this. This was 1911, so Holmes has died and, spoilers for the Sherlock Holmes canon, come back to life. And so Doyle was actually still writing Holmes at this point, and I didn't know what he would make of this. Apparently he did not find it terribly amusing. He wrote something of a rebuttal to Knox. I didn't bother looking it up because I figured we'd end up down a rabbit hole. You know. Fast forward to 1929, and Knox is asked to write an introduction to what will be a collection of supposedly the best detective stories of 1928 and 1929. And in his introduction, which is several thousand words long, he lays out this Decalogue. There are a couple of things that are interesting about this. Firstly, that he says, I mentioned this Decalogue earlier. I previously said that I have these 10 rules. I couldn't find an earlier record of them anywhere, so quite how formally stated these were, that's one thing entirely. The second thing that's really quite interesting as well is that a lot of people know the Decalogue in its very pithy form. If you look at the versions of it that are generally circulated, they are 10 quite pithy rules. Number one, the criminal must be someone mentioned in the early part of the story, but must not be anyone whose thoughts the reader has been allowed to follow. Number two, all supernatural or preternatural agencies are ruled out as a matter of course. And so on and so forth.
Much different to Van Dine, who's spending you know, just paragraphs and paragraphs laying out his laws.
Precisely. Yeah. So then you get to the introduction of this book. Rule one. The criminal must be someone mentioned in the early part of the story, but must not be anyone whose thoughts the reader has been allowed to follow. The mysterious stranger, who turns up from nowhere in particular, from a ship as often as not, whose existence the reader has no means of suspecting from the outset, spoils the play altogether. The second half of the rule is more difficult to state precisely, especially in view of some remarkable performances by Mrs. Christie. It would be more exact to say that the author must not imply an attitude of mystification in the character who turns out to be the criminal. So straight away, you've gone from what is, a 20-word rule to what is, I'm not even going to try and count, more than 24 words.
Yeah.
Same thing, rule two. You get, you know, supernatural, preternatural agencies are ruled out as a matter of course. To solve a detective problem by such means would be like winning the race on the river by use of a concealed motor engine. And here I venture to think there is a limitation about Mr. Chesterton's Father Brown stories. He nearly always tries to put us off the scent by suggesting that the crime must have been done by magic. And we know that he is too good a sportsman to fall back upon such a solution. Consequently, although we seldom guess the answer to his riddles, we usually miss the thrill of having suspected the wrong person. So every single one of these rules, there is actually some common, he calls it commentary, there is some commentary on each of these rules, which is very interesting on account of the fact that obviously we all know the Knox Decalogue is controversial on account of rule number 5,
mm-hmm.
No Chinaman must feature in the story. I mention this for a couple of reasons. Firstly, because unfortunately you can't talk about the Knox Decalogue without mentioning the No Chinaman.
Of course.
Secondly, because when people talk about the Knox Decalogue, they hark back to the studies in the literature of Sherlock Holmes. And they're like, well, you know, he wasn't really being terribly serious. It's all a bit fun. It's all a bit kind of lighthearted. It's, you know, it's not really supposed to be taken seriously. I have an issue with that because actually so much of what he writes is fairly reasonable. I think there are probably 6 worthwhile precepts here and 4 to make it up to a nice biblical number of 10. So I'm actually not convinced that this defence of, it's all supposed to be a bit laugh. Don't, you know, look at his Sherlock Holmes stuff. That's all kind of deeply hilarious. Actually, the kind of mind that would construct those studies in the literature of Sherlock Holmes is going to have, a bit like we talked about with Van Dyne last week, a reasonable, like a fair acuity when it comes to assessing the validity of detective fiction. To pick something apart that rigorously, actually, I think you are doing it moderately seriously to go through and say, right, here are the 10 precepts on which I predicate detective fiction. I actually think there's a lot more seriousness in this than he is typically given credit for. What's amusing is that he almost seems to be in a bad mood because he's introducing a collection of stories. And there's sort of a point towards the end where he's like, well, I mean, some of these stories aren't very good. I mean, to be perfectly honest, you'll figure out at least half of it. I'll tell you what, I will quote you the bit that I thought was quite fantastic.
Can't wait to hear this.
Some of the stories in this collection deal, ingeniously enough, with the question of identity. But I do not think there is one of them which really keeps the reader on tenterhooks of excitement, wondering who did it.
Thanks for your lovely introduction.
I know, right? So these books are fine. These stories are fine. So I do think there is a lot of common sense in here. I do think it is actually, I would take it as being not entirely seriously. And there's a point about a not entirely serious approach that I wish to come back to later in this episode. I'll leave you on tenterhooks yourselves about that. But at the same time, yeah, I think there is an aspect of this that is actually taken far more seriously when you see the longer version of the rules. I think we go, oh no, the Chinaman thing isn't entirely serious. Actually, it is a very, very interesting point. He says, no Chinaman must figure in the story. Why this should be so, I do not know, unless we can find a reason for it in our Western habit of assuming that the celestial is over-equipped in the matter of brains and under-equipped in the matter of morals. I only offer it as a fact of observation that, if you are turning over the pages of a book and come across some mention of the slit-like eyes of Chin Lu, you had best put it down at once. It is bad. So, essentially, this is an exhortation against this very lazy yellow peril. what I read in that is that your villain is going to be someone who really should be well motivated, well understood, and you're not falling back on lazy tropes. The point he makes there is a really good point. You need to be a little bit more intelligent about how you are using your villains, about what your villain's motivation is going to be. He talks earlier about shockers, what we probably call thrillers these days, and how actually once you open a thriller, you know that it's going to have these slightly outlandish ideas. And he says, you know, often you'll get to the end and find that the exciting situation presented at the start hasn't actually been resolved, probably because the author has entirely forgotten about it. And to me, it feels like a more of an extension of that, that actually this needs to be based on slightly more rigorous principles. So actually, I do think there is quite a lot of very solid reasoning behind these ideas, and it is actually probably supposed to be taken more seriously than these apologists would like to claim.
Both Van Dine and Knox betray their love for this genre, absolutely, simply through making the list in the first place, but also through the fact that they've gone to such depths in it. They do see it as an art form, as something of value, as something of beauty, as something spiritual, as something important. And it's easy to shove things aside and say, oh, but he didn't really mean that. Or, oh, but let's not focus on that. Or, you know, he had religious stuff, but let's forget about it. You know, all those kind of serious things that they actually do really care about. And we can do that too easily with detective fiction, I think. And I think these rules allow us to say, actually, let's really get into this. It is a worthwhile artistic venture.
It's interesting how Knox and Van Dine both use a lot of very similar language to talk about them as well. Van Dine made the reference to sport. Knox likens the detective novel to cricket, and the sort of the duel between the writer and the reader being like that between the bowler and the batsman, and talks about the observation of rules and how somebody can play foul. Van Dine talks about the importance of the reader being able to put their finger on the point where everything sort of makes sense. The Knox introduction, you know, says the author on his side counts victory if he succeeds in keeping the reader in a state of suspended judgment over the criminal or complete mystification over the method. And yet if he can show the reader the point where he must have solved the mystery, where the light effectively must have been given to him, which again was part of what Knox talked about there. I kept trying not to interrupt you last week when you would say something, because I was like, oh yeah, actually that crops up in Knox as well. There is, I imagine, probably quite an interesting comparative post to be made out of.
Absolutely.
Just the sheer not just the list, because the lists have enough crossover as it is. But if you look at the full articles surrounding the lists as well, actually they couch them in very similar terms. There's a fabulous quote here which says, "The skill of the detective author consists in being able to produce his clues and flourish them defiantly in our faces. There," he says, "what do you make of that? And we make nothing."
That's great.
You know, and it's like, I feel there is, I think you're right, there is that real love and that real insight that comes from wanting the genre to be something. There's a point where Knox says, "Nobody can have failed to notice that while the public demand for mystery stories remains unshaken, the faculty for writing a good mystery story is rare, and the means of writing one with any symptom of originality about it becomes rarer with each succeeding year. The game is getting played out. Before long, it is to be feared, all possible combinations will have been used up." And then 2 years later, John Dixon Carr embarks on an 80-book odyssey to prove just how many different ways there are to, you know, reframe and reshape these narratives. And it's really interesting that they have this kind of hopelessness that the detective novel is not going to be what they feel it should be, which I think is part of why we look back on them and sniff at them a little bit. And I think, in general, the lack of understanding of context has enabled more modern writers to adopt a slightly mocking and a slightly dismissive attitude to them. There's a BBC interview with Val McDermid, and she's asked about the Knox rule, and obviously they reel out the one about the Chinaman. And Val McDermid says, oh, well, you know, I think the authors back then obviously took them very seriously, but now we just kind of play a bit fast and loose and we don't worry about them. And you go, no, they didn't take them very seriously. Knox took it seriously. Mm-hmm. Van Dine took it seriously. But I wouldn't say anybody who was a contemporary of Knox's felt obliged to stick to his rules. He acknowledges himself, people are not going to stick to the rules. There are definite
exceptions to these rules where they're done incredibly well. And it's almost like that sort of that relationship with something where you love it so much, but you recognize that it's not always going to be what you want it to be, but that's not necessarily a bad thing.
I think it speaks to their professions, both of them, prior to writing detective stories. Knox is obviously a priest and a theologian and wrote many theological texts. Mm. And Van Dyne was a critic. So they're both making exegesis about the things that they're reading. Therefore, these are two men who were able to look over a genre that is already working and existing and draw out this exegesis about its meaning. Mm. I think that's quite fascinating. These rules didn't... Knox didn't write these up and then everyone started writing, which is kind of what that Val McDermid interview suggests.
Yeah.
But actually, they're already looking back. Yeah. And then now we can look on from that. And it's just fascinating to think that they spend their time doing that work and drawing it out. And it speaks to their love of the genre again, as we've discussed, but also to their abilities to do such a thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is part of what we were talking about at the start of last episode, this idea that actually the rules started to creep in to meet an expectation of a type of story. So the writing was already there. But, yeah, they are just... looking back, shaping it, giving it some kind of form. I mean, I feel if you want a commentary on the detective novel, I feel a far more pertinent one would be just the text of The Poisoned Chocolates Cake. I think that book is probably a far more rigorous exploration of the Golden Age detective novel than either of these lists.
In fact, all 30 of these rules across both, I think, are shown up at some point in The Poisoned Chocolates Cake in a narrative form. Mm. So, yeah, why not start with that?
There's one... interesting one here. There's one point I'd like to just get your thoughts on, where I feel that Knox misses by a quite significant distance.
Okay, here
we go. I'll read you the sentence. He's talking about detective stories. The story derives its excitement only from the danger of the criminal getting off scot-free or of some innocent person being condemned in his place. Now, the... exceptionally knowledgeable, phenomenally well-read and dearly missed Noah Stewart once made the point that there are only three genres in which you know the ending in advance: detective fiction, romance fiction, and pornography. Knox here says, so much excitement, will the criminal be caught? Whereas I don't think we ever pick up a novel of detection, a Golden Age novel of detection, wondering whether the criminal's going to be found out. Because, of course, the criminal will be found out. We know they don't always face sanctions. So there's a list of rules written by Raymond Chandler slightly later, late 1940s, I think. And one of his rules is the criminal must face a sanction. You know, they must be punished. They must face some...
form of justice,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah. For what they've done. Which was often not the case in Golden Age detective, which is part of where the genius amateur, or just the amateur detective, would come in. They would have the freedom. You know, there's a couple of Henry Merivale novels, there's a couple of Gideon Fell novels, there are some Roger Sheringham novels, there's novels by Agatha Christie, you could probably name any number of authors, where the criminal goes free, but they're definitely identified, and correctly identified. Whereas Knox wants to claim that actually there's this tremendous tension around, oh my God, are we going to find out who does it? Well, yeah, surely, of course. Even in 1929, this was a given.
Are they going to get away with it as a form of tension?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't actually think I've ever really thought about that as a form of tension. I think I do agree with you. He has missed a mark. To say as well that the story derives its excitement only from the danger of the criminal getting off scot-free is very interesting.
Mm.
I mean, it speaks to his views on the desire for us as humans to see wrongs righted, you know, and that speaks to morality in detective fiction, which is a really important point. And again, that's something that Chesterton draws out in his little essay on it, where he compares it to the Greek tragedies, that it's... someone passing through these terrible struggles and they're changed and in the end justice is met. But yeah, to say that's the only form of excitement is quite limiting, isn't it?
I mean, I would argue that the most exciting aspects of detective novels are the unexpected things that get dropped in. The point where you realise that everybody in The Problem of the Green Capsule has watched the same events and come up with different conclusions of what's happened. That's incredibly exciting. And then you watch the film back and they're all wrong. And the way those things unfold most unexpectedly, I would say, for me, that's where the excitement comes from. You never doubt that a criminal will be found and will be at least confronted with their crime, even if they don't face punishment, even if the detective just decides they get to go free for whatever reason, for a moral reason, because the crime is morally justified, as happens at the end of at least one Agatha Christie novel. But you know that they are going to be confronted with it and they are going to be identified.
How do you see Knox's list? Useful? Helpful? Is it something that you abide by or not?
I think, as I said before, there are probably 6 rules on here that are worthwhile,
mm-hmm.
and 4 that just made it up to a nice biblical number of 10. So, undiscovered poisons. No accident has ever helped a detective. I think they're very interesting key concepts at the heart of what we love about detective fiction.
Both of those rules also present in Van Dyne,
yeah,
just to put that in there.
And again, yeah. And this is something which, I mean, it's incredible. There's so much crossover. Yeah, no, I'd be really surprised if Knox's list, an introduction, came out organically without any awareness of Van Dyne's. I think it's interesting for a focal point. I think it's a shame that the commentary on the rules isn't as widely known. And so I think it's a shame then, as I said, that we feel the need to be a little bit apologetic about the Chinaman thing and claim that it's not entirely serious, because it's like we're not taking the detective fiction itself seriously. And I wonder if the Knox list, in its slightly more pithy form, because they're shorter, because you say Van Dyne's list is effectively 30 rules anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so because the Knox list is shorter, maybe that's the one that's just easier to refer to. At the same time, I feel like because it's shorter, that's also the one that it's easier to not engage with so fully and therefore dismiss if one wishes to be snobbish about detective fiction. You enjoy something because you see it being done well, because you see it being done in an entertaining, in a creative, in a very vibrant, in a very effervescent way, inside of all the limitations that are put on it, you still come up with something that catches you out. That's the brilliance of it, and I think that's something that they're definitely both trying to capture. So maybe it cuts both ways.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we've looked at these 2 formalists. We can have a debate over how serious they're intended to be, how useful they are in terms of discussing the genre. But I wanted to look at this idea of maybe the detective story doesn't take itself super seriously anyway. Now, 1928, you've got Van Dyne writing his list. 1929, you've got Knox writing his. 1930, you have the formation of the Detection Club, which is effectively this social club for detective writers to get together to discuss, frankly, whatever they want to discuss. It's a fascinating concept. Martin Edwards wrote about it really quite brilliantly in his book, The Golden Age of Murder. And we know, thanks to that, and thanks to previous work by authors like H.R.F. Keating, that the Detective Club has an oath all members are required to take when they are inducted to the club. And the oath's very interesting because of what it says and because of what it allows, and because of how it's obviously not taking itself seriously, but it is taking itself seriously at the same time. And I just wanted to have a brief discussion about this. Now, we've published a list of Knox rules, we published a list of Van Dyne rules, they're very easy to find. And I thought, because this is an oath, I didn't just want to put up the transcript of the oath. So, and Dan is unaware of this until right now, Brad Friedman has kindly recorded.
Oh my, here we go.
Mr. Bradley Freeman of Our Sweet Mystery Blog.
Here we go.
Very kindly has recorded the oath for the membership of the Detection Club. And here it is.
Great.
Is it your firm desire to become a member of the Detection Club? That is my desire. Do you promise that your detectives shall well and truly detect the crimes presented to them, using those wits which it may please you to bestow upon them, and not placing reliance on, nor making use of, divine revelation, feminine intuition, mumbo-jumbo, jiggery-pokery, coincidence, or the act of God? I do. Do you solemnly swear never to conceal a vital clue from the reader? I do. Do you promise to observe a seemly moderation in the use of gangs, conspiracies, death rays, ghosts, hypnotism, trapdoors, Chinamen, supercriminals, and lunatics, and utterly and forever forswear mysterious poisons unknown to science? I do. Will you honor the King's English? I will. Do you, as you hope to increase your sales, swear to observe faithfully all these promises which you have made, so long as you are a member of the club? All of this I solemnly do swear, and I do furthermore promise and undertake to be loyal to the club, neither purloining nor disclosing any plot or secret communicated to me before publication by any member, whether under the influence of drink or otherwise. If there be any member present who objects to the proposal, let him or her so declare. Do you then acclaim this detective story writer a member of the club?
Yes, yes, yes.
You are duly elected a member of the Detection Club, and if you fail to keep your promise, may other writers anticipate your plots, may your publisher do you down in your contracts, may strangers sue you for libel, may your pages swarm with misprints, and may your sales continually diminish. Amen. Amen.
Thank you, Brad. Yeah. What a joy. Absolutely glorious. Thank you so much.
So it's this idea that obviously this... So I'm fascinated with this idea.
We're serious about detective fiction
here.
We're serious.
I'm fascinated by this idea that trying to impose rules upon people about how they can write their books, while there is a certain expectation that a detective novel should do a particular thing. At the same time, if it doesn't, so what? You know, and this is from an era where you had Barclay in the club. This is from an era where you had Dorothy Sayers in the club, where you had Agatha Christie in the club, where you had Freeman Walls Cross, where you had people who were hugely, hugely influential and really shaped the detective novel as we talk about it today. I mean, you know, we talked about those examples of very nascent detection forms in the mid to late 19th century. But actually, this is being put together by people who really defined this genre, who would probably be as serious about it as anybody ever has been. And they're not being entirely serious about it, as we know. There's Eric the Skull who lights up and all those kinds of things. It's all supposed to be a little bit over the top. At the same time, you have Ronald Knox's slight disdain where a story doesn't quite hold up to the level of rigour that we feel it should have. And I almost think there is this idea sometimes when you see the rules of something, it's like, well, obviously the rules are there because rules are for squares and no one has any fun with rules. And it's, but actually...
made to be broken.
But I think there is this definite seam of self-reference. And I wonder if that is where this idea that the Knox list isn't entirely serious comes from. Because people are aware of the fact that actually detection as a genre, yes, it has to fall inside of certain trappings in order to be considered detection. And yes, of course, there are things that we want these books to do. But not everybody who would fall into the bracket of Golden Age detection fulfilled all of those obligations. We can all name books where clues are withheld. We can all name books where there is a resort to some kind of a poison, or there is some, you know, perhaps not super criminals and lunatics, but an element of criminal conspiracy. Christopher St. John Sprigg, his book that was published by the British Library, is a really good book, but there is that sort of massive criminal conspiracy that comes in towards the end to kind of justify all of the actions. But it's still an incredibly good detective novel. And I don't know, I'm just interested as to what you think about it.
In my mind, this is maybe the best way I can explain it. If I was watching someone being sworn in or being sworn in myself, say if I broke every one of those rules in a book, I might not actually really be writing good detection, and I might actually be being unhelpful in the work that I'm making. And yeah, if I wrote a novel where the solution was to do with someone who wasn't present through the entire book to the last minute, I could be like, yeah, well, the rules don't really matter. But it wouldn't be a good story, you know, and because the rules do mean something. And yes, as you say, we can be tongue-in-cheek and it can be funny, but really, it does matter in some sense, doesn't it?
And I feel once you're not adhering to those rules, that's the point where you cross over, or those expectations, let's say, that's the point where you cross over from detective fiction into crime fiction. Patricia Cornwell's debut novel, I remember because I read it about 20 odd years ago, the
guilty party is just pulled out of nowhere. It's no one who's featured in the book until any, and they get 15 pages from the end and they go, oh, because we've gone through all this forensic medicine, we've identified that this is the person, they go and find them, and it's just some rando. And so that's perfectly allowable inside of the kind of book she's writing, but that stops it being that sort of detective. But you're no longer playing the same sort of game that Christiana Brand played. You're no longer playing the same sort of game that Sayers played. You're not in the same bracket as these authors anymore.
And maybe it comes back to the term being fair, which of course is a debatable term, fair play. But maybe there is something unfair to call something a detective novel if it doesn't in some way abide by these laws and hold them up with a degree of respect, actually, I think.
But then at the same time, inside of that, it's just a bit of fun, isn't it? And obviously it's not being... So there is that there's that really interesting threshold between the two where you're just like, it's fun. Oh, you've gone too far now. It's almost like... It's almost like...
Or it's serious. Now it's too serious. Now you're kind of just boring everybody. Yeah. What's the fine... That's a fine balance, isn't it? A quite interesting and striking... maybe it speaks to a lot of art. The idea of seriousness or joking can be a make or break of a lot of experience with art. Some people feel they can't engage with, say, ballet or opera because it's too serious. Or sometimes people go to contemporary galleries and because of their feeling or understanding of art, feel like they're being tricked by the artist because, oh, my son could make this, you know, who's 5 years old. And there's a fear around enjoying or not knowing how to react to something. Is this serious or is it funny or not? And maybe there's a cultural anxiety around that, and the detective novel, in a funny way, hits that really hard.
I don't know if there's a way to resolve it, and I obviously, as ever...
I don't even know what it is.
No, I know, strange, right? It's crazy, isn't it? And, you know,
strange,
I mean,
substance.
This isn't just you and me doing this for therapy, although that helps. We are also extremely...
I'm doing it for therapy. Okay, I don't know about you.
Dan is going to pay me at the end of this. This is
great. I cannot afford therapy.
Dan is not going to pay me at the end of this. Obviously, if you guys have an insight on this that you want to offer, please do. That's the entire point of doing this and putting it out there.
But it's just a bit of fun in the end, listeners. Oh, it's absolutely. Just a bit of fun.
For God's sake, don't take it too seriously, whatever you do. But we do want to know what you hear, but don't be serious about it. So, those are the Knox and the Van Dyne lists, and a brief swing into the Detection Club oath. As Dan said, this is going to be a three-part episode, but part three is going to come out in 2 months. That will technically be the next episode that we release. Would you like to explain why?
What we're going to be working towards in episode three is something of maybe what we could call a set of rules or a decalogue towards locked room mysteries. What are the things that we might think, and you as our listeners might think, are key laws, rules, precepts that have to be followed to make a brilliant and credible impossible crime or locked room mystery? We're going to do it as the next episode to give you a bit of time to give us some suggestions. In the comments, please do give some thoughts about what you think makes a brilliant locked room mystery, and we'll gather those things together for the next episode.
Thank you in advance for your contributions, and particular thanks to Brad Friedman for his fantastic reading. If you haven't checked out Brad's blog, it is rsweetmysteryblog.wordpress.com. Give him a look.
As ever, you can find me on WordPress at The Reader Is Warned.
And I'm presuming, since you're listening to this, you've already found me, but I am at The Invisible Event.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.